folks.
Hello.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ball Game.
Oh, Take Me Into the Ball Game. Gosh, that wasn't like him at all.
I was like, your Goofy sounds remarkably like your Jimmy Stewart.
Mary, gosh.
Mary, yuck, yuck.
Yuck, yuck. That's right. I want a big one. Gosh.
So that is, I don't know, Goofy, Jimmy Stewart, the love child of Goofy and Jimmy Stewart. Don't think about it too much, folks. That is Eric Gildy.
Hello, it's going really well so far.
And I am Ellen Adair. It's going so well. And we are two actors who decided that we would...
So-called.
Yes, it's so-called actors. We're not voice actors, y'all.
Yeah.
I definitely don't do impressions.
Hanna-Barbera is not lighting up my phone.
No, by no means. We're more like on-camera and stage actors.
It's true.
And yeah, we decided that we would watch baseball movies, television shows, cartoons, etc., and grade them on the 20 to 80 scouting scale.
And we are people of our words.
And we are people of our words.
We have done it. You won't call us liars about that statement that we made about that thing that we said we do about watching the baseball movies.
Yes. It might be a 30 grade Goofy impression, but it is an 80 grade doing the thing that we said we would do.
For sure.
So this week, we are talking about the 1942 Goofy cartoon, How to Play Baseball.
How to Play Baseball. Yes. This 1942 cartoon was directed by Jack Kinney and written by Dick Kinney and Sylvia Moberly Holland.
I assume the Kinneys were related?
I think they were bros.
Otherwise, that's an amazing coincidence.
Like bio bros.
Nice.
Jack Kinney worked on lots and lots of great Disney stuff. And, you know, he was on the directing team that was responsible for Dumbo and Pinocchio. Like my favorite cartoon movie ever, Pinocchio. Not Dumbo's fine, but you know, whatever.
I was like, oh, the Disney movies that make you cry. I mean, there are other ones. Bambi, obviously.
For sure. One of my favorite stories is when my brother first showed Dumbo to his oldest daughter, Abby. When Dumbo and his mother were separated, he was like in tears, like having like big parental feelings. And Abby was just like, bye-bye!
How old was Abby at that time?
Oh, gosh. Like, super young. Like, oh, four or something like that.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Anyway, in Jack's IMDb bio, there is an entry under trademarks. You know how, like, sometimes with IMDb bios, it's like trademarks, and it'll be like things that they're known for. And for him, there is one that is, quote, furiously paced, violent comedy, which I really like. Like, rock and roll bangarang. That's pretty fun.
Yeah. This cartoon is not exceptionally violent.
No, but it's got a certain energy to it. It's got a certain slap stickiness, if you will. And I think it fits within that ultimately. Anyway, Fred Shields provides the narration of this comedic instructional in which a whole bunch of goofies give an overview of baseball that is, quite frankly, a little bit goofy. Shields' career included a lot of radio. As a result, there's not really a lot that people would have heard of, and his IMDb profile is a little bit scant because I do not know that there is an internet old-timey radio database, but if there were, he'd be on it, and it would be a prominent profile, I believe.
IOTRDB.com.
Yeah, exactly. Rolls off the tongue. However, the work that he's done that you probably have heard, the best chance at least, speaking of Bambi, is that he provided the voice of Bambi's dad, aka the Great Prince of the Forest, as well as the narrator of How to Play Golf, another one of those goofy joints, The Three Caballeros, and also other stuff. This cartoon is the first of the how-to cartoons that Disney did. And, you know, there are plenty of others, including golfing, skiing, fishing, football, etc.
I haven't seen Bambi since it scarred me as a young person, and so I did not even remember that Bambi's dad was A, a character, or B, the deer formerly known as the Prince of the Forest.
Oh, yeah. No, he's... He's a good-looking deer. I'll leave it at that.
Where's the name proudly?
So
this is what it's like when deers cry.
The only other thing that I will say before we move on is that this cartoon was produced at the request of Samuel Goldwyn and rushed to completion in 12 weeks so as to be ready to play before screenings of, wait for it, The Pride of the Yankees! Our number two episode, not in terms of quality necessarily, but in terms of order of production, this is a nice way to, again, bring it back to the beginning of our podcast.
Yeah, it's sort of like, because we recently did our anniversary episode with Major League 2, this is kind of like an anniversary of our second episode.
Yeah, I like that. That's exactly what it is. So anyway, that's all I've got in terms of the introductions.
Excellent. So if you have not seen this cartoon, first of all, it's on YouTube. Just Google Goofy How to Play Baseball. Yeah. It's 8 minutes. It's delightful.
Yeah. You can also find it on Disney Plus, but honestly, if you just like Google the title, you will have multiple viewing options.
So many different places to watch it. But if you really don't want to do that for some reason, what you should know about the general parameters of this cartoon is the first part of it is a little bit more instructional. The narrator guides us through aspects of the game of baseball. And then the second part of it is a little bit of gameplay of a World Series game.
It's really funny. It's like, here are some simple things about how baseball works. Cut to the bottom of the ninth of Game 7 of the World Series.
Yes.
Like, it is, things accelerate very quickly.
Yes. Yeah, but there's sort of those two aspects to the story.
Yeah.
And if you're just joining us for How to Play Baseball, perhaps looking for a tutorial and being slightly waylaid, the first thing to know about the 20 to 80 scouting scale is that 50 is average, but that means an average major league player. So since we're talking about prospects, if you can find a prospect that you think is going to be an average major league player, that's actually quite a good prospect.
Yeah. I don't know. This feels a little bit cheating, but like, let's do animated dogs.
Oh my God, yes.
50 grade dog for me in terms of the animated variety of dog. I'm going to go like Santa's Little Helper in The Simpsons. Perfectly good dog. Factors into a number of storylines, contributes, but, you know, is like neither weak nor like a star.
Yeah, I love this, obviously. We're great dog lovers on this podcast. And I struggle, though, to think of dogs that are less than 50 grade. So if you don't know, 45, 40, 30, and 20 are progressively less and less good when describing baseball prospects.
Yeah, this is tough for me also. The things that I can think of are Odie from Garfield. Not because I think Odie is a bad dog, but I'm just saying like Garfield is from Garfield's perspective.
And so Odie is just kind of a doof.
And so Odie's just like a little bit of a doof. But like I would take in Odie and love him and care for him and give my life for him. And so
wow, I didn't know you felt so passionately about Odie.
Team
I still
Odie.
Feel like Odie's a 45 or a 40.
Yeah, yeah. Below that, I'm going to say like Ren in Ren and Stimpy.
Oh.
He's so great in so many ways. But if you think of it in terms of like a dog that you would want to be responsible for.
Yeah, no way.
Oh, man. Really towards the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
And I, otherwise, I don't know. Like maybe the dog from Blue's Clues, just because he leaves all those blue footprints like all over the place. And I'd be cleaning up. Constantly.
A total mess. Are there, in like The Secret of Nim, are there mean dogs in that? I mean, I haven't seen
Probably.
That since I saw Bambi, so I don't really remember. Yeah. I feel like maybe there's a mean cat, but I don't remember.
Right. Oh, and it's not animated, but there's that dog in Fraggle Rock, right? Oh, man.
I'm going to have to just take your word for it.
Boy, oh boy, that dog really didn't like Fraggles.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're clearly on the same page here.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the baseball arena, 55, 60, 70, and 80 are better and better, with 80 representing a franchise player or a Hall of Fame level talent.
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, Goofy is up there in this. Pluto as well.
Oh, I don't know, actually. That I think about it, I think for me personally, Pluto might be a 45.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just because of the total oddity of a mouse owning a dog, but also being friends with a like bipedal dog. It's always bothered me. And not just like as an adult, as a child, I was like, this is wrong.
It's one of the great mysteries of the universe. And
it's like the Holy Trinity, but with Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
It's like somehow Pluto is a companion dog for this mouse.
Yeah, it's
and
one of those,
also,
you really need to like go to some secluded place to contemplate it.
Yeah,
because it is very.
I want to say, by the way, for anybody, I say that as like a general fan of Christianity. By the way, I don't want to offend.
General fan of Christianity. That's amazing. I love it.
I don't know. I don't think it's fair to call myself a Christian anymore, but I'm down with Jesus. He's
other,
cool.
Wow. We're really getting into some deep stuff.
We're really getting
here.
Into some deep stuff. I feel like the dog from Up.
Yeah.
That can speak feels like.
Hi there.
70 grade dog.
Yeah. We've also got Lady Bird from King of the Hill, which I think is like a 60.
Okay.
55, 60. That's
I
a good
I have
dog.
Not seen that show enough to really judge.
We've got Snoopy, of course.
Snoopy's
How could
80.
We forget Snoopy.
Snoopy is clearly.
Clearly an 80.
The 80 grade cartoon
also
dog.
Also in 70, I think, is Seymour, a.k.a. Philip Fry's dog in Futurama, who really only appears in like one episode, but like a model of loyalty.
But what? Wait, what? Grade did you give him?
A 70.
Okay. All right. 70. All right. I feel like he's certainly not famous enough to warrant. I don't know. He might be more like a 60.
Oh, but such a good boy.
But what about Snowy from the Tintin series?
Oh, that is
I think
also like a solid
70.
70.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, sure. the number of times that Snowy really ends up saving the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Well,
I think we've clarified that.
I think now
and
that we've
some other things.
Now that we've dealt with that little bit of housekeeping, we can get on to the serious matter of talking about this 8-minute-long Goofy cartoon.
Yes, and before we do that, I just again our lawyers, this is the lawyers of the organizations that Eric and I scout for. It's not our podcast lawyers. Like, we're not fancy like that. I just want to clarify again, since last time we were embroiled in a Twitter battle using images of Grogu, and since Alan Sepinwall went on the podcast and argued that I should be banned from podcast appearances, all because we covered baseball bugs on this podcast, that we are not saying that this Goofy cartoon is a movie or that Baseball Bugs is a movie. We are a cross-genre podcast that doesn't qualify anything that we talk about here to be a movie. Is Aaron Nola a movie because I mention him on every single podcast? No. I mean, Aaron Nola could be a movie if he wanted to be, but he's not.
Hey, listen, all I know is that this is a cartoon that was made in Hollywood and screened on the big screen before the Pride of the Yankees, and that's good enough for me.
Yes, but it's not a movie. So, our first tool is Amount of Baseball.
I mean, I don't have a whole lot to say other than, like, weirdly, I think I'm going to give this an 80. It's pretty much all baseball all the time. This is exclusively baseball. I'm not going to say it's great. I'm not going to say it's totally accurate. But, like, this is a thing that the whole point of it is baseball start to finish. And, you know, like, the waiting could be a little bit suspect because this is an 8-minute cartoon. This is one of those things that you have to kind of, like, take into account. Like, also when you read, like, 19th century baseball stats and you're like, this is amazing, but the game was very different back then. This feels like that type of an 80 grade.
Well, totally. And I mean, it's been a little while since we've done anything but feature length films. So if you haven't joined us for any of our previous television or cartoon episodes, it's important to note that long ago we decided that amount of baseball is a ratio stat and not a counting stat. So yeah, obviously this is an 80 grade amount of baseball.
Yeah.
Really, the only things that don't qualify for amount of baseball by my own metrics is the shot when Goofy is modeling the baseball uniform and the shots of the American flag at the beginning and the end. But I will grant that flags have a very important role to play at the ballpark in terms of letting you know what the wind is doing.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the mere existence of a flag, even in a baseball context, qualifies as amount of baseball.
Yeah,
even well, so.
And even then, like, when you mention the baseball uniform, what's the first word of that? Baseball.
It's true, but I don't count somebody just being in a baseball uniform as amount of baseball for a feature-length film.
Well, listen, I double count it, so it works out that we both count it on the averages.
You know, this is why we've got different scouting ethoses and are employed by different organizations and have different gyms who are our scouting directors. So even so, this is an 80 grade, because even the gold standard for live-action amount of baseball, which I believe is the independent film 12, has non-baseball scenes, so I'm definitely going to allow the uniform and flag shots.
Nice.
So our next tool is baseball accuracy. And baseball accuracy-wise, I feel like this cartoon fares much better.
You almost said film.
Shh! Don't let our legal team know. No, don't let Alan Sevenwall know. Yes, but I didn't say it. Crucially, I didn't say it. I almost said it, but I didn't say it. So we're not legally liable for things that we almost said and didn't say. So yes, this cartoon fares much better than Baseball Bugs. There are even some positive baseball accuracy points.
For sure.
But the largest concentration of baseball accuracy issues that I had might be in the section in the beginning, sort of expository section, when the narrator is telling us how, quote, simple it is to follow plays on the field.
Which there is very much a tongue in cheek in that, to
yes,
be sure, but
but I still think I need to grade it baseball accuracy wise.
Yeah.
So for Baseball Bugs, I determined that the ways in which baseball accuracy grading is different for a cartoon is that I will give a pass to the notion that physics accuracy is baseball accuracy, because a cartoon does not have the same physical laws. However, I can't also give a pass to tongue-in-cheekness, because then I'm just going to be like, oh, well, it's a cartoon, so 50, because everything's meant for humor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, our narrator says, first of all, the game is quite simple, as there are only 9 players to watch at one time. So, who is he not watching? Presumably, he's watching the batter, a very mm-hmm. important player to watch, who is actually the 10th player on the field. So, is he chosen to not watch one of the corner infielders? And this feels like maybe the logical choice, if you have to choose to not watch one of the players, but it's sort of unfair, given that apparently you will be watching the other corner outfielder.
Yeah.
I think I maybe said corner infielder earlier, but I meant to say corner outfielder.
All right.
So don't hold me legally liable for having said corner infielder earlier.
Hey, listen, I forgive you.
So already, you know, there's a small problem. But then the scene that unfolds is a kind of complete defensive pandemonium that I am glad to say is not accurate. I am glad to say I have never seen this at a baseball game. And friends, I am a Phillies fan. And I have watched the Phillies of the past 4 seasons. And even the past couple of days, whose defense made me cry into my pillow just this weekend.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested to hear what you have to say, because I might have like a slightly contrarian pushback to it.
Great. Okay. So here's an Ellen Adair breakdown of what occurs. Breakdown! I had to watch this clip 10 consecutive times to parse this out. So what I'm saying is, you're welcome. So the ball is hit to right, and the first baseman, rather than covering first, starts to run to second. So the pitcher has to cover first. Then the shortstop covers second because the second baseman starts running towards first for some reason. At this point, if we're tracking the ball seems to be wandering around in loops in right field. What is happening? Is the right fielder constantly booting the ball in a circle? So while maybe that's what the right fielder is doing, here's some of the defensive routes that are ultimately taken. And it's hard to tell. It's a little bit like a Jumbotron shell game with baseball helmets to figure out what's going on here. So the first baseman runs through the shortstop spot and then well into foul territory. I don't know if he's doing some sort of a do-si-do with the third base coach. Unclear.
Possible.
But he ends up covering third. Well, okay, because this is downright logical in comparison to the second baseman who runs around the infield grass and over the pitcher's mound, again way into foul territory, and settles on the baseline between third and home. And this is particularly problematic since the catcher has abandoned home plate long ago, running up the first baseline and back to end up near the pitcher's mound. Nobody's covering home. And the third baseman runs on an infinity loop in the shortstop hole before, I guess, trying to back up the shortstop at second base, which is silly because the shortstop is the only person on the whole team who does something logical. Like, they cover second base and stay there.
So my impression was that actually the second baseman went into kind of like shallow right field to be a potential like cutoff person, catch the ball, etc. I understand everything that you're saying, and I mostly agree with it, but I will say there is something accurate about it. Because, well, just to step back a little bit, the cartoon is like, baseball is really simple, and then it provides this like extraordinarily complicated sequence of movements related to a bloop into right field. And so the thing that is accurate about that, that I think is significant, is that in any given play in a baseball game, even if it's kind of routine, there are all of these people on the field who are potentially going to be making adjustments. And it can actually be like very, very complex where people move, who's covering whom, et cetera, which I feel like is the driving point of that moment. And although it is not necessarily accurate in terms of like, especially as it goes on, you've got this like center field goes to cover right, left goes to center and vice versa. And you just like at the end of it have this huge mess of lines. Because if you haven't seen this before, it's all done as kind of like a diagram of the diamond. And you're sort of like seeing the play with like dots and lines as opposed to actual players. And it just becomes this gigantic mess. And although it is like very exaggerated, I felt like I saw the truth of like, actually baseball's complicated. And when a ball gets hit somewhere, everybody has their job to like do a thing to help get that out, which I appreciated.
I get the joke, but I don't think it's accurate. Does that make sense? So like, just because something is inaccurate doesn't necessarily mean that it is bad and shouldn't exist, but I have to score against it for the category baseball accuracy.
I think I thought it was maybe more accurate than you did.
And I think, yes, because, and I think I'm annoyed at it a little bit, despite what I just said, because it feels to me like a baseball is hard propaganda moment. And like,
baseball is hard.
It's not that hard. It makes sense. Like, what players do to cover the respective positions in a play has a logic to it.
Sure.
Whereas the thing that we see is completely illogical. If that was what the play was supposed to be, there would be no way that we would ever understand what the players are trying to do. So I get that it's comedy, but I don't even think the idea of it is totally accurate.
Yeah, I guess I just appreciated the fact that it does allude to the complexity that is possible even within a simple play in terms of like how every member of the defense needs to kind of like be aware and make little adjustments based on what's happening with the ball in play. Like that's kind of what I took from it.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, it's also true that all of this madness concludes with the narrator saying that the runner is, quote, out or safe or either or neither or both. And only the first three are options. We have replay review specifically to avoid the neither or both scenarios, although I grant that they did not at the time.
Yeah, I kind of took that a little bit like this should be a binary of like out or not out. And, you know, treated as such. But even now, even in the age of replay review that our good old pal Goofy didn't have the benefit of.
That's true.
Calls are still disputed and even replays are disputed and not even thought of in terms of like whether or not a thing happened, but it's like, is that enough to overturn, et cetera, et cetera. That to me, like, I'm not going to say it's accurate to say out or safe or either or neither or both, but I again felt like a certain amount of truth just in terms of like the kind of ultimately subjective nature of certain calls and how there will always be people who like argue whether something happened or didn't. That although inaccurate, there is like a tiny hint of accuracy.
It's getting to the truthiness of it. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
You are into my interpretation, I can tell.
No, but I'm just allowing you to have your own opinion about it.
There is some really good stuff at the beginning, like the first half, I guess, where we sort of really do a rundown of various gear and attire, et cetera, et cetera. The ball itself is appropriately the very first part of it.
The cork and rubber core is carefully wrapped with yarn and covered with tough horsehide.
Yes, yes, yes. That is exactly what is said. And I don't know. I'll just use this as a reason to talk in an incredibly brief way, because the history of the baseball is like long and pretty complicated, actually. But essentially, like in terms of baseballs, you know, baseball's been around for a really long time, and they were all made by hand at first, right? So teams attempted to standardize the size and shape of baseballs as early as the mid-1850s, like pretty early on. But of course, being completely handmade, there was a ton of variation. There were different amounts of rubber in it. The winding of the yarn was like either tight or loose, and that affected the kind of like bounciness of the ball.
As we have seen.
As we have seen. So there was like a lot of variation in general. In 1876, with the creation of the National League, A.G. Spaulding, you heard of that last name, right?
Mm-hmm.
He succeeded in his proposition to get his balls to be the balls of baseball, of National League
Just
baseball.
Sometimes I'm 12. Like, it's not that often, but, like, sometimes it happens.
And so Spalding's balls graced the baseball world for 100 years.
Oh, man, if only we had an ad read for manscaping.
Rawlings became the official baseball 100 years later in 1976, but it was Spalding all the way before then. Spalding, by the way, speaking of old-timey 19th century baseball stats, he pitched pretty well in his career with the Boston Red Stockings, and a year and a little bit of another year, only like a few games for a second year, with the Chicago White Stockings. In his seven-year career, he had a 2.13 career ERA with, get this, 279 complete games.
Oh my goodness.
And a record of 252 wins to 65 losses.
Nice.
Different times, different times. He also had a .313 career batting average, for example.
Wow.
But yeah, there have been obviously like numerous changes to the ball over the years. There were the sort of corked rabbit balls that appeared kind of midway through the dead ball era. The cushion cork center that was implemented in 1925, and also the rubberless balls that happened during World War II when they were trying to conserve rubber, took the batting way, way, way down as a result. And, you know, there's continuing controversy surrounding the juicing or otherwise changing of the balls, where things have, you know, been done to affect the bounciness.
Totally.
And also the spin of the ball based on what the level that the stitches are at. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's definitely what we've seen in 2021, because in the previous balls, in the sort of like super bouncy 2017 to 2020 balls, part of the issue was that the seams were so tight that the balls were intensely spherical. So the balls that we have in 2021 are actually bouncier, which is why exit velocity is up across the league, but the seams are higher, which is why we're seeing more pitching dominance, and also why ultimately sort of lofted fly balls don't go quite as far because there's more drag on the ball. So yes, for sure, this is all just teaching us what a delicate ecosystem Major League Baseball is.
Yeah, and also this thing of like the ball continues to change over time, and adjustments will probably continue to be made so long as baseball is a sport.
Yeah. In terms of the statement in this particular cartoon, that it was horsehide at the time was accurate. It is not horsehide anymore, for anybody who's curious. In 1974, it was changed to primarily be cowhide, just because horsehide was not as readily available.
Yeah, listen, we've only got so many horses.
It's true. And we eat enough cows that I guess we can use the rest of them for baseball.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, yay, it's a family show.
There's also talk about, you know, bats and gloves. There's some fun stuff about all of that.
When the narrator says the uniform is loose-fitting to allow freedom of movement, I was like, you have not seen Walker Buehler's pants.
Yeah, no, that definitely was related to like a different time in baseball where things were like wool and felt and not the more form-fitting things that are happening currently.
Yes.
And regards the gloves, I'm just going to go into one other quick thing regarding that. Charlie Waite is among the earliest people to use a glove, which is funny because like we just associate that, but like there weren't always gloves. And he was the first confirmed, at any rate, in 1875, although Doug Allison of the Cincinnati Red Stockings. By the way, the comment of the team name is based on the
color of the socks
that he's being wears, like, is not wholly inaccurate because there are so many teams, especially in old-timey baseball, that are the something socks or the something stockings, that there is like some truth to that. So I'm going to give some accuracy points to that.
Yeah, it would just be complicated these days when everybody sometimes has the same gear because it's Armed Services Weekend or it's Mother's Day. And so it's like, today everyone is the pink stockings.
Yeah. So, you know, there's obviously dispute about like who was the first. I say let's give it to Charlie because, you know, he had a career war of negative 1.5. So, like, let's give him that at least. Spalding, our good pal, put forward a glove design after that. And Cardinals pitcher, actually, Charlie Waite was also with the Cardinals. So there's some real Cardinals history with the development of the baseball glove, but Bill Doak in
You
can never escape the Cardinals. 1920, Bill Doak was like, hey, what if we had some webbing in that glove? And people were like, hey, maybe that's a pretty good idea. And so that continued on. Obviously, gloves have evolved since then. Modern gloves are super, super duper specialized with different sizes and shapes, depending on the position that you play. But yeah, anyway, just seems worth mentioning some of these things as the first half of this cartoon is like, here is the ball, here is the glove, here are the shoes that you wear, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And after we've talked about the equipment, the narrator starts talking about pitching and pitching mechanics. And as much as the narrator declaims that the windup is not overdone, I think that that pitcher's mechanics could clearly be simplified. He literally ties himself up in knots. Like,
it really does.
It's going to be an IL stint sooner or later.
Yeah.
It's a red flag. How did this guy make the majors?
Yeah. That goof cannot sustain that kind of
physical. He might have a few good like results, some excellent pitching lines. Everybody's like, oh, six innings pitched, one earned run. Yeah, he can't keep this up.
Yeah, no, that's a very like goof hard, die young kind of
for sure.
Approach.
For sure, goof hard, die young. Oh my God, I want a jacket, like a leather jacket that says goof hard, die young so much.
Oh, yes, I will. I'll talk to my leather guy.
Great. Excellent. Horsehide or cowhide, either is fine. So then we've got all the descriptions of pitches, and this is an instance where cartoons get a pass for physics accuracy, because particularly the curve and the slow ball seem to be defying the laws of physics, or at a minimum, they are using some of the substance from It Happens Every Spring, but I am not docking this baseball accuracy points for that. But Goofy the pitcher throws both right and left-handed during the same at-bat.
Incredible.
So I'd say, once again, we have a Pat Venditti situation, except for even Pat can't do that. Like, I believe that he has to declare that he is pitching with one hand or the other before an at-bat. So this is a no-no, and not the kind of no-no that even Wade Miley is capable of. And the spitball is hilarious, but no one could throw a spitball in 1940, true. They were outlawed in 1920, and the last legal spitball was thrown in 1934 by Burley Grimes, who was among the pitchers whose spitballs were grandfathered in as still being allowed.
Grandfather spitball. It's pretty fun that the spitball, like, spits.
I love the moment.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sorry that it's in the cartoon, but it's not accurate.
Yeah. Well, it is not accurate in terms of it being an above board thing. Like, I think that there have been people who have used illegal pitches clearly in the time since, but
that never happens. Ever. I mean, don't look at Trevor Bauer's spin rate or anything, but
no,
that never happens. Speaking of which, speaking of spin rate, what do you think the spinner pitch is? Like,
I don't know. That was a confusing thing, because it is presented as like, sometimes you want pitches to be straight, like this spinner pitch. And then this is a pitch for people who are listening who maybe haven't seen the cartoon or haven't seen it yet. Like, you, if you're listening to this, you should watch this cartoon. It's 8 minutes long. We're way further than that already in this podcast. Like, come on. Yeah, it is an exceptionally curvy pitch for being presented as a straight
pitch.
Well,
the rotation for a cartoon seems the most like a slider rotation. You know what I mean? The way that the slider has sort of like that kind of record player type of a spin to it. But it doesn't break. Like, by design, by introduction, it doesn't break. So, I mean, it breaks the batter's bat, but
but I will say that I do think that in terms of accuracy, the cartoon does a pretty good job of relaying like the different types of pitches that a major league pitcher will use to, you know, hopefully strike a batter out or whatever, in terms of like really having it be like speed, timing, movement, and...
Well, I mean...
I think the other one's just like a knuckleball of like a who knows what's going to happen. Right. But I think that like for being as silly as it is, like it actually does sort of pinpoint various types of pitches, if not actually being like super accurate in terms of like, this is what a slider looks like. This is what a cutter looks like. This is a curveball, et cetera, et cetera. Like I think that the gist of it is conveyed decently, actually.
Yeah, none of this is actually a baseball accuracy problem for me, with the exception of the spitball, which I love and I'm glad it's there, but like I'm giving negative baseball accuracy points. And I actually think, for example, when the narrator says the pitcher holds the ball in such a manner as to cause it to curve when thrown, that I'm like, that is what happens. Yeah. Like that is a more accurate depiction of how that happens than, for example, Aunt Mary gives in Aunt Mary.
Aunt Mary.
Mary.
That was my Goofy, by the way.
Yes, clearly, obviously. So moving along to the World Series game that we see, the bottom of the ninth inning in the World Series game, we see this overconfident pitcher take a too early curtain call.
Yeah. He's like doffing his cap and waving to the crowd even as he's pitching. Goofy. Come yeah. on.
I mean, ultimately, it's almost a baseball accuracy problem because I just don't feel like any pitcher would do that if they still had another out to get. But the first batter that we see hits a ball up the third baseline, but running to first base, he trips over a bunch of bats that are lying on the foul line. And apparently, the pitcher has no hit the opposition. And I sort of had to wonder at that moment if having a bunch of bats lined up along the baseline has helped. I mean, if Zach Godley was creating interference, causing that ump to award Isan Diaz first that one time, this is definitely interference.
Yeah, I mean, also made me think of the moment in Pride of the Yankees where Lou Gehrig stumbles over all of the bats.
Yes.
And that just made me think, like, oh, maybe like where you put your bats was like a problem in the 1940s.
I mean, maybe it was, yes. But the next batter is hit by a pitch, and he is not following concussion protocols by deciding to take first base with his head.
Yeah.
It seems unsafe. Mm. And I want to know, in both of those cases, where is the first baseman? Not that there was a play to be made, necessarily. I mean, maybe in the first case.
Uh-huh.
But, like, where is he? We never see the first baseman pictured. It's very disconcerting.
Put that Goofy on the back of a milk carton.
I guess.
Because he is missing.
Because he is missing. Erroneously regarded as baseball accuracy issue is the moment when the catcher, pitcher, and third baseman collide and no one gets the ball, since I have seen Bryce Harper and Odubel Herrera do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah. Ooh, boy. There is a line about, you know, $500,000 and the World Series, and I'm just going to mention that this is like a thing that, I don't know, I feel like people don't generally think about and isn't often discussed, which is the player's share. Each postseason team receives a share of the money earned from the playoff gate receipts. The World Series champion receives the highest percentage, followed by the runner-up, so on and so forth. And the player's pool is formed from 50% of the gate receipts of the wildcard games, 60% of the gate receipts from the first three games of the division series, 60% of the first games of the championship series, 60% of the first four games of the World Series. And that has been a thing that has gone on for a very long time. Historically, oftentimes like a World Series share would be more than the annual salary of some mm-hmm. like lower mm-hmm. paid players. So it's really a big deal and like continues to this day. These days, a full winner's share is kind of like generally in like the mid six figures. I feel like the most recent numbers that I could find were sort of like just under $500,000 for the winners. And then like, you know, a little bit below that for the World Series the losers. I hate calling them losers because, man,
they made the World Series. Yeah.
And, you know, it's very complicated. It's more complicated than is worth getting into here. But, you know, there are like full shares, there are partial shares. There's definitely like a lot of insider stuff in terms of like how it is divvied up. But that is like a thing that I feel like actually isn't talked about that
much. It's not.
Much.
No, it's super interesting.
And
I didn't
very
know
interesting. Yeah.
The exact percentages or the exact figures.
But so, yeah, accurate.
Thank you for my education.
Mm-hmm.
So I think an interesting baseball accuracy question in this cartoon is the final climactic play in which the ball comes completely apart and is just a large pile of yarn. So I was sort of curious as to whether or not the ball would be dead at this level of disintegration. But I think according to the rules, it would be a live ball.
Oh.
So rule 3.01 just says, should a ball come partially apart in a game, it is in play until the play is completed. Now, of course, this hinges, I guess, on the phrase partially. And I think chiefly it's because it's unlikely that a ball would fall apart to this degree in a unanimated major league game. But some examples of, well, the main example that I found was that in 2014, Martin Maldonado, on the Brewers at that point, hit the cover off of the ball in a grounder to third, but when Pedro Alvarez fielded it and threw it to first, the ball was so lopsided that it didn't make it there in time, and Maldonado got a hit.
Mm.
So that counted. It wasn't even an error. And a similar thing happened with Tony Walters in 2017, but it was more softly hit up the infield, and it was fielded by the pitcher, but Walters did reach. And
nice.
Interesting points, Bryce Harper, Jose Abreu, and Jose Reyes have also sliced open balls that they hit. However, they ended up as foul balls in the dirt, so there wasn't really a question as to whether or not they were still legal in terms of gameplay.
Yeah. Well, and there was that one game that we went to where we had like the super duper nice seats like right behind home plate at Citi Field, and Jose Reyes did it that one time where he like did a big swing and it did take the cover off the ball, but it did this thing. It was so cool where it just like sat there like foul right behind the plate and just like spun for a really long time. It was very, very cool.
That's the instance that I am talking about of Jose Reyes
doing
that very thing.
There you go.
But honestly, I had forgotten that we were at that game.
Not only were we at that game, we were like best positioned to see it.
My long-term memory is really terrible, folks. It's
oh boy,
very
oh
bad.
Boy. Not a Jose Reyes fan, but that was super cool.
Yes, definitely not a Jose Reyes fan, but it happens to us all. So let us think for a second. I just want to praise, this isn't a baseball accuracy issue, but I want to praise the speed of the center fielder who catches the unraveled ball
mm-hmm.
and somehow makes it to home from center field at the same time as the runner who is rounding third. That is one fast dog. No wonder he's in center.
Hey, good boy.
Good boy. Good boy. So for me, I think that this is a cartoon-adjusted 40 in terms of baseball accuracy.
Okay. I'm of a similar mind. I gave it a 45. I was a little bit more generous, I guess. But yeah, I'm like, it's pretty good, but it's also like a silly cartoon that is not like fully accurate.
Yeah, but I think that you giving it a 45 and me giving it a 40 sort of tracks in terms of some of the slight disagreements that we had about some baseball accuracy points.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So, shall we move along to our next category?
I think we might as well. We're almost an hour in.
Great. So, our next tool is storytelling.
I think it's pretty good. You know, like, it's simple, it's straightforward, but, like, I think it gets a lot into the 8 minutes in terms of talking about the sport in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way that's entertaining, like, laying out the various pieces of it, the way that the game works, and then taking us to like the highest stakes version of the game, i.e. the World Series last game, and we're in the bottom of the ninth. Like, I think in general, that's pretty solid. And yeah, I don't know. Like, right now, I'm kind of at like a 55 with it.
Okay.
Where I'm like, you know, it. I don't know that it necessarily reinvents the wheel, the goofy wheel, but I think it does.
What is the goofy wheel?
It's a wheel, but it's goofy.
Somehow I just imagine it being like the Shakespearean Wheel of Fortune with Goofy like bound to the wheel.
Yeah. I think that there's some really fun stuff that is done in the cartoon in terms of like what is said versus what is shown, which I like a lot. I mean, one of the examples that we've already talked about is like when the narrator is like, the game is really simple. And then we see this like super complicated like series of events shown on the diagram of the diamond of what happens with this little hit into right field. But I think that that also happens with other things in terms of like illustrating the various parts of baseball. Like, for example, when they talk about like the shoes, and it's like they're sturdy, lightweight, and comfortable. And we see one of a couple of like cross sections diagrammed here in it. And in this case, we see this like patched sock with a hole in the toe and a like terrifying human toe sticking out of the sock that Goofy the dog man has. What is his biology and anatomy? I don't know. I don't know that I want to know. It's so terrifying. It's the island of Dr. Moreau. Yuck, yuck. Situation. But there is this weird foot with like various nuts and bolts from the spikes sticking up into the shoe and like further mangling this mangled foot inside. And I think the cartoon does a lot of like really fun things of sort of being like, the shoes are created to do this good thing, and then kind of like showing you, if not the opposite, then something that is like definitely in opposition to what has been said. And I think that there are a lot of like really fun visual gags with that that I really liked.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree that that kind of comedic juxtaposition is the engine of this cartoon. And it's an interesting cartoon to judge storytelling wise, since it sort of does have the two sections. And I think that the storytelling is clear all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that this sort of bifurcated nature of the story makes it not quite as satisfying as Baseball Bugs. And so I think it's also a 55. I think it's very enjoyable and clear, and it's well done, and it's amusing. And some of the only problems that I have with it come right at the very end. The cartoon basically posits that a player's complaint to an umpire is an example of Americans' protected free speech. And that is why baseball will always be America's sport. And just sort of, I mean, I don't know, this could almost be a baseball accuracy issue, but just like basically no, actually, players will get tossed from a game for arguing with an umpire. This is not an example of protected free speech.
Yeah, I again took that as like some delightful tongue-in-cheek talk, especially, I don't know. I've been reading so much about like dead ball era baseball and also like baseball immediately following that, and reading about like people getting into fights with umpires and all of that. And I don't know. There was something about that that I sort of appreciated and liked, because I think that that player umpire relationship is another thing that has evolved a lot over the years.
But, and I mean, players still get in arguments with umpires, but it's not protected free speech. It's the opposite of that thing.
No. Totally. I think that I took it that the cartoon was kind of winking when it said that, I guess, is my ultimate point.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I guess if that's what baseball being America's sport hinges on, then that is maybe why it's not America's sport anymore.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
The only thing that I think I would change if I were writing this is that it sets up that in the World Series, our team, the narrator's team, is the one who's on the mound and in the field. So this is the pitcher who's doffing his cap and taking his curtain call, as we've discussed, having gotten two outs. So the cartoon does end with the game going to extra innings, I guess, because the runner, it's 3-3 and the runner is called out.
Tis ambiguous.
Yes, yes. Schrodinger's baseball game. But for the satisfaction of a young person, wouldn't it be nicer to imagine that you're on the side getting those hits? I mean, even if it's like one of them is a hit by pitch, that your team, the home team, after all, batting in the bottom of the ninth, is trying to rally against this pitcher who's taking a curtain call too soon? Anyway, that was the one thing that I was like, oh, that's an interesting choice to have like your team be the one that gets its comeuppance. But maybe that is also an important instructional point about how heartbreaking baseball is.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, in terms of storytelling, I will just say that I think that there's a lot of like very fun cartoon interpretations of baseball in this. There's like the super fast ball that is so fast that it's flaming and it turns the bat into a matchstick that's been burnt up. And
there, I mean, this pitcher's arsenal is really wreaking havoc on the opposing team's equipment.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And like a slow ball that is sort of like, there are a number of like pitches where the ball is basically like sentient, like the spitball, like actually just sort of like stops and spits in the face of the batter.
It's one of my favorite moments, yes.
The slow ball basically comes up to the plate and then like actively dodges the swings. Like there's a lot of really fun stuff like that. You know, there are a lot of baseball cartoons, especially from this era. And I think this does a really good job. This is a good example of a cartoon that I think is, you know, like very respectful of what the sport is, but like super, super playful in terms of like, how can we have fun with / exaggerate the nuances within the sport? I think it does a really good job. So I like it. Again, I don't think that it is Baseball Bugs level of quality, but I think it is well above kind of like a typical cartoon. And so I feel very comfortable with a 55.
Yeah, I do too. I do just want to say that the ball being sentient, sort of problematic when then the pitcher takes a bite out of the ball later.
Yeah.
Yikes. I mean, that hurts for everybody. That probably even hurts for his dog teeth.
It also takes a little bit away from the skill of the pitcher. If it's like, well, if the ball is in control to some extent, what is the pitcher doing if the ball is...
Yeah, the ball is just this little, like, demon.
The ball's like, I got this. Yeah. And so the pitcher is... It's just
I could be a pitcher if the ball was in control.
Exactly, exactly.
So our next tool is the score tool.
Score tool!
And I think this is an easy 60.
I think I agree.
It's really quite delightful, and it also matches with the animation in a lot of places, or sort of otherwise works in tandem with the sound design in a way that's very satisfying. And I also enjoy that a building block of a lot of the music is swing, which is fun. But all of this said, I don't think that Paul J. Smith's music reaches the same echelon of Carl W. Stalling's for Baseball Bugs. So that's why it's a 60 and not anything higher than that.
Yeah, I think it's really good. It is solid cartoon music. It is peppy. It is fun. It is like kind of dramatic. Like you feel the stakes of the moments that are in the cartoon. And it's dramatic in a way that helps really, like, lay out the stakes. Like, it's just very, like, exciting and tense and fun. And so, hooray for this music. There isn't necessarily, like, a ton to it. Like, it's not necessarily super complicated, but I think it does like exactly what it needs to do and does a good job of that. So yeah, 60.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think retrospectively, the fact that it is naturally 1940s music being from the 1940s makes it more fun.
For sure.
So our next tool is acting.
You know, This is a cartoon, as we have discussed. So the acting, like, mostly falls on the voice acting done by the narration done by Fred Shields, who I think does a really good job. I think I'm going to go, like, I don't know, I might do a 60 also.
That's
with this.
Fair.
I'm like tempted to maybe be 55, but I'll be generous with a 60. I think he does a good job. I think that there are a number of things that he kind of like needs to do, a number of like bells that he needs to ring with it, in terms of both being like, I am kind of announcing what's happening in this game, but I'm also doing a kind of like documentary style, like, let me tell you about baseball and what is happening with it and how the game works. And I think he does a really good job with both of them.
Yeah, I think for me, a 60 is totally fair, but for me, it's a 55. I just think there's not a ton to go on. It's mostly the narrator, since Goofy doesn't say much. And I think he does a more than competent job, but I think there's sort of a ceiling for it in terms of the goodness that I really receive from acting in this cartoon.
Totally fair.
So our next tool is the delightfulness of catcher character. And honestly, I think this is one of the biggest disappointments for me when compared to Baseball Bugs, where the catcher Bugs Bunny is really the best of all the Bugs Bunnies. You know, that's the old Pepper really Boy. Good. That's the old Pigeon.
It's really good. Yeah.
But the goofy catcher is rarely even pictured, much like the missing first baseman. When we see the batter, we almost never see the catcher in the same frame.
Yeah, there's really, honestly, in my memory, only one kind of like standout moment for the catcher, which is when he's like trying to catch that pop-up and very delightfully takes the mask off, takes the hat off, even takes his chest protector off, which is a really, really
it's a good
funny
joke. Yeah.
And so I will definitely like award some points to the delightfulness of that moment, but yeah, largely absent.
Yeah, I agree. That's the only time that we see the catcher. Mm-hmm. So I feel like 40.
Yeah, I think that's where
I mean, I thought about 30 because he misses that pop-up, which is sad, to me. I did sort of wonder, is the catcher maybe the answer to which player is the narrator not watching, given how little run the catcher has in this cartoon?
Well, especially because there is narration in the cartoon of like, the pitcher is the most important person on the field, blah, blah, blah. Which, you know, I sort of respect it and I don't fundamentally disagree with. But in terms of position players, like, you could definitely make a case for the catcher being like a centerpiece of the team and like how it functions. And, you know, just generally the catcher is considered to be kind of like a strategic leader of the team, and the fact that that was kind of glossed over in this makes me kind of agree that that might be the player that the narrator was not looking at
when
talking about nine players.
Yes. Yeah. I will have more to say about this later, but basically, I agree.
Wonderful.
So, what about delightfulness of announcer?
This kind of gets folded back into the acting thing. The announcer, such as they are, is the narrator. The narrator
I agree that I think the narrator counts as the announcer here.
Yeah, which is not to say that the narrator is only an announcer, because sometimes what he does is very much not announcing, but sometimes it is that.
Yeah, so, he's calling the game, and there's that shot of the radio, and I wasn't sure if we're sort of supposed to understand from that shot of the radio that he's the radio announcer.
That we're like, that, yeah. We're
and he's also been helping us through this
yeah.
how to play baseball, sort of like Scott Fransky doing an ad for TimberTech decking or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. So whereas I went 60 with acting, I'm going to go 55 here, just because I think that he is good and I like a lot of what he does, but I don't know that all of it is like fully announcing.
Mm.
And so Yeah, I'm like hedging a little bit with this one.
It's funny because I'm just going to flip-flop with you. I feel like he's a 60 as delightfulness of announcer.
Oh, hey, hey, do-si-do, you and me, again. Yeah,
because I sort of feel like for acting, there's a ceiling here. But for announcer, it's like he's one of the main parts of our entire enjoyment of this whole cartoon.
That's true.
And like he's right more often than he is wrong. And despite having a team, I feel like he's decently impartial. So I would listen to his radio broadcast for sure. 60. Are you going to change a score?
I'm going to give you that sound cue.
Ra-pa-da-pa-pa-pa-pa.
60. Yeah, sure. I'm with you on that.
So our last tool is lack of misogyny. And I mean, this cartoon has some misogyny through lack of any kind of non-male perspective or entity even existing in this world.
That's kind of the main thing.
It's sort of like if this cartoon were its own little planet, this species would be doomed to extinction because there are no women.
They no ladies in this thing.
Yeah, I took this note. Spinner pitch is emasculating because it creates wig? But I think that that is stretching it. So, you know, I don't know if we have established if lack of misogyny is a ratio stat or a counting stat, but I have to say, just from the truthiness part of it, having an 8-minute cartoon without a single woman in it is not as bad as having a 110-minute like live action movie without a single woman in it. So,
or a 110-minute movie that has like 5 minutes of ladies.
Yes, in it. Yeah, yes, yeah, even yeah. And yeah, and like disparaging comments made about them, et cetera, et cetera.
Totally. So, yeah,
I think allowances for the amount of time that you decided to not have a single woman must be made. And also the fact that there are no disparaging comments made about women. Like, they just don't exist.
Yeah.
So I'm going 40.
I wrote down 45 / not applicable. So I think we're like more or less on the same page.
But I do think not having a woman doesn't make lack of misogyny not applicable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give us some lady goofs.
We need lady goofs. Yes. Yes. Live goof, die young. So let's move along to our next segment, which is yes or no. Would this cartoon be better with Kevin Costner in it?
I don't think so. I wouldn't think of taking a role away from Goofy, for starters. And I don't think that Costner would be a good match for like the level of energy that the narrator announcer dude role kind of demands. So unless we added like a segment of like, and here's what the fans think, and like Kevin Costner was just like happened to be there watching the game. I don't think so.
I'm personally going to disagree with you. For me, this is an absolutely yes, 100%. I want Kevin Costner, like as himself, Roger Rabbit style, not a cartoon Kevin Costner. Actual live action Kevin Costner as literally any one of the infielders in that final World Series game. Like, I want him as the second baseman being like, WTF guys, what is this? Like, why are you all bipedal dogs? Where is the first baseman? Where is the catcher? What's going on?
I will agree to this and fully support it so long as the terms include that Kevin Costner in this situation is dressed in a like goofy Halloween costume. So that it is very much recognizable as Kevin Costner.
Yes.
But we see him in the, you know, like you see the like catalog photos demonstrating the costume.
Yes.
I want to see Kevin Costner in that way.
We do not want it to be a Disney World, Disneyland goofy costume where the head is not visible. We want the like Kevin Costner face to be seen between the jaws of the goofy costume.
And it might not even need to be like a fully like licensed goofy costume. It could be one of those costumes that you see that like is just sort of like,
it's like funny dog.
Funny dog, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm on board for that scenario. Otherwise, it's a no for me.
Yeah, for me, it's a yes in either case, with or without Goofy branded or non-branded costume. But
with or without Goofy, I can't live.
Thank you so much for staying with us, listeners. We really appreciate you.
With or without Goofy.
Does this movie reference Babe Ruth?
I believe this is a sans Bambino cartoon. However, the Babe obviously does appear in The Pride of the Yankees, as we all well remember. So the people originally viewing this cartoon would have seen the Babe mere moments afterwards. And so I don't think that that counts. I also am not sure that it doesn't count. So this is one of those either or neither or both situations.
Yeah, I think I'm going to say that it doesn't count.
Yeah, I think it's basically no.
But I like your effort. And I think one of the reasons that I'm going to say that it doesn't count is because for our next question, is there a dog in which, friends, there are many dogs in this cartoon.
There's so many.
There's
goofies.
So many dogs. It's such a relief. But I feel like we would then have to go back and revise our scouting report on Pride of the Yankees and say, yes, there's a dog in Pride of the Yankees, just because...
Because this cartoon preceded it. That's fair.
Yeah, so I feel like it just, it creates a sort of paperwork mess. So.
Yeah, but as far as, is there a dog? Yeah, I mean, so many.
Many, many goofies. Dogs.
This is, of course, the Goofy style dog, as opposed to the Pluto style dog. This is the bipedal, weird human toe.
I mean, that's a whole other thing. Yeah.
That feels like that. That's like
I got something to say about it.
That's like a season of cereal as opposed to.
yes, it really is.
Anyway.
Are Yankees fans the main antagonist of this film?
No. I mean, honestly, the fan experience isn't really a focus here, so there are no fans of any kind. Also, you know, it's worth mentioning again that the whole reason that this cartoon exists was to help draw people into the Pride of the Yankees.
You're it's just so going to put this whole episode straight into like a voiceover reel for yourself.
Hey, listen, trying to just put myself out there, you know. Though I will say, you know, the fact that they do say that the team is based on the socks that people wear does make me think that the fans of these teams are Sox fans, which
I'm smelling what you're cooking.
Maybe be inherently in opposition to the Yankees, which would maybe make them antagonists to the Yankees.
Yes, indeed. This was also my answer. There isn't an antagonist in this cartoon, which is actually sort of nice and refreshing. There isn't one. But since both of the teams depicted are Sox teams, I think it's fair to say that Yankees fans aren't not the antagonists.
Yeah.
So, what about 6 degrees of baseball?
All right. This was hard and impossible because we really just have Fred Shields, who is not, as we said, someone who has prominent stuff. He probably did radio stuff for other baseball things, but we will not know because of time and of, you know, the Ozymandias stuff. Read your Percy Shelley, y'all.
Do it.
What I will say is that this is the time that I really have to cheat a little bit, but I think it's a little bit interesting nonetheless. And I cheat only because I will say there is an actor named Pinto Colvig who did the voice of Goofy from the very beginning. All the way back from his introduction as the character originally named as Dippy Dog. And when this cartoon came out, Colvig was in the middle of a falling out with Disney, leaving Goofy without a voice. Actually, that's part of the genesis of the, quote, how-to type of cartoons that Goofy appeared in at this time. You could include the character without really relying on the voice because the narrator took care of that. So Disney did that and just used little bits of Kolvig doing Goofy that they already had, although that's not even really the case here. The only Goofy voice that we get in this cartoon is the argument over the final play between Catcher Goofy, Runner Goofy, and Umpire Goofy, which are decidedly non-Goofy voices. Anyway, after a little bit of time, the relationship mended and he resumed the voice of Goofy. But I'm going to say that Pinto Kolvig is the voice of Goofy and Goofy is in this cartoon. And so I'm going to say that Pinto Kolvig also appears in the 1944 MGM short Batty Baseball as the pitcher. It's a super weird and like surprisingly dark cartoon that I watched as I was learning all of this. And it's really funny. And I hope that we do it in the future sometime because it's super, super different. So it's cheating a little bit because Kolvig doesn't appear in this, but he is the voice of Goofy and he also did this other thing. So that's what I'm sticking with.
It's what we've got to go on, friends. Yes, Eric has done a scholarly deep dive to bring us all that we can for 6 Degrees of Baseball this week.
Oh, yeah.
What about a favorite moment for you?
It's all really delightful. And so I am just going to pick out one thing that maybe a casual viewer would not notice, and that is when we enter into the World Series part of this cartoon, I was incredibly delighted by the newspaper headline that, I mean, the headline is like, World Series tied as we like enter into the game part of this cartoon. But one of the subheads on that newspaper page, if you pause and watch it, is Goofy on Mound as Series Goes into Finals, which I just find super delightful in a world that apparently is only occupied by Goofies,
yeah.
That they used that, like, column space to specify that it was Goofy on the mound. And so I'm just going to pick that.
That's great. That's very delightful. For me, it's pretty clearly when Goofy, as the batter in the early explanatory section, rubs dirt all over himself as part of his at-bat ritual.
Ooh, that was a close second.
The music here is really excellent. And I think it's the funniest moment in the whole thing. I mean, there's no carrot song in four-part harmony, but this moment is great. What about least favorite moment? I wonder if it's the same as mine.
I don't know. It's probably not. This was another one that I struggled with because it's a fun cartoon. I like it a lot. It's great. You should watch it. I think it's when he takes the bite out of the baseball instead of the plug of tobacco, just because I think it's a funny idea, but I don't know that the execution totally works.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, that's it. Like, I get what it's trying to do. I get the, like, tobacco baseball player thing. And, you know, this pitcher is, like, so focused on the other thing, so full of anxiety about the game that he takes the bite out of the one thing instead of the other thing. There's something about it that I think just, like, doesn't totally work. Like, it's not set up well. It's not executed super well. It's a good idea, but I don't think it ultimately works.
Cool. Yeah, I agree. For me, however, hands down, my least favorite moment, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is when we see inside of the baseball shoe.
Ooh.
So the first problem, and Eric has talked about this before, and I stayed silent because I was waiting to say my piece here at this time in the podcast. The first problem is all the kinds of weird bolts and screws that look extremely painful to walk on. It's like slightly too close to, I don't know, a Saw movie for a 1940s cartoon for my tastes.
Yeah.
But even more horrifying, Goofy's toe. We see Goofy's toe poking out of his sock, and it is everything about it is wrong. I understand. In this moment, I understood why Goofy and Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse are always wearing freaking gloves, because frankly, I do not want to think about the digits of these strange anthropomorphic creatures. Mm-hmm. And the worst part is the fact that the toe is the toe of a Caucasian human being, when Goofy the dog clearly, obviously has black fur.
Yeah. Like, he is a dog of color.
If it has to be an anthropomorphic toe peeking out, shouldn't it at least be black? Like the rest of his mm-hmm. body, whose toe is that, is my question. Like, does he have Caucasian human feet sutured to the bottom of his loopy dog body? Like, is this a Saw movie? I'm going to be scarred for life, and I am significantly older than the target audience. I cannot deal with that toe. I can't deal with it.
Yeah, that is a good choice. I thought about using that as my example, but there was something about it that was so...
Well, you like horror movies and I don't. I like to be in them, let's be very clear, but I don't like to watch them.
Yeah, I feel like I was delighted by how terrible that was.
Oh God, no, like it's given me chills up my spine. So what about the scene you would like to see?
Okay, so what I think is that this should have a scene where the goofy, like, slugger visits a sick kid in the hospital who is also a goofy, like a Johnny Sylvester goofy. And then that would be really fun and also take care of our Babe Ruth problem.
Great.
That's my suggestion.
Excellent. So the practical scene that I would like to see, if this were 1942 and I could give notes, is a little bit more of a love for the batter in the pitcher-centric early narrative. So we learn about all different kinds of pitches, but couldn't we learn about all different kinds of hits? Like, this is the humpback liner. This is the home run up an elevator shaft. This is the kind of fly ball that's going to get stupid fans really excited because they're not looking at the fielder, etc.
And as our friend Craig DeVino would say, don't have an understanding of basic geometry.
Indeed, yes. However, what I would really, really like is a narration about the role of the catcher.
Yeah.
You alluded to this earlier. I'd love it to be the 2021 version so that we could talk about pitch framing and Goofy could go, yuck, because he stole a strike by moving his glove up from the bottom of the zone.
Oh my God, give me that. Put it in my veins.
Yes. But honestly, I think we should have an introduction to the catcher, even if it's 1942, now that I'm thinking about it. Like, talking about how the catcher is the one telling the pitcher which pitch to throw, and the catcher is the one controlling the running game, and the catcher is the one who is the lovable team leader, with him, like, high-fiving another goofy who just came back from getting a sack fly.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I want. Yeah.
So, okay, real talk here. Which goofy is the dreamiest goofy?
Well, it's obviously the goofy that has that sort of line drive that obliterates the ball. Like,
I agree. It's
the goofy who does Dr. Meredith Will's ball dissection job for her.
Yeah, because the pitcher goofy...
Absolutely not.
He's way too narcissistic and also, like, super sweaty.
I mean, that one batter is pretty sweaty as well. That's not necessarily an issue for me.
Yeah. I mean, the other choice is the goofy who, like, tries to remake the ball that gets exploded and, like, goes in for
and is so fast that he can tag home at the same time.
I think that either of those goofies is an acceptable choice for a dreamy goofy.
And
because,
I mean,
like, that's really, like, going above and beyond. That is a team player of someone who is like, I am going to remake the ball and also come in from the outfield to try to get the out at home. Whether or not it worked, again, it's ambiguous. You got to give some points to that. But also, like, the goof that is knocking the cover off the
ball.
I mean,
that's some exit velocity, you know?
Yeah.
For sure, that's what I was thinking. But, you know, I mean, with my love of defense, I don't know, maybe I should have chosen the other goofy.
I think they're both acceptable choices.
I think they're
both
good choices, yeah.
And I think I might ultimately agree with you, but I just
don't...
Yeah,
we got to throw some love at both of those.
I don't want the other goof to go unnoticed.
Yeah, yeah, yes, completely. So, I don't know, favorite performance? Like, there's almost not anything to discuss here.
Given everything that I said, I nonetheless will say that it's probably the Goofy who hit that shot at the end.
Oh, I mean, I was just thinking performance is acting. It's really only the narrator here. So I guess the narrator is probably my favorite performance.
Oh, yeah. In terms of like actual people, it's definitely the narrator. But in terms of like which... I guess it becomes like another like a redundant, okay, like, so, which goof do
well,
you
no,
like
no,
the
no.
most?
So I think if that's the question, if the question is which Goofy's performance do I like the most as an actor, as mm-hmm. opposed to as a baseball player.
Or just like as a Goofy.
As a Goofy, I think it has to be the batter that we see stand in who rubs the dirt all over himself.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. I think that I'm personally going for the one who, like, hits the shot at the end of the game that not only, like, tears the cover off the ball, but then, like, he hits an almost maybe inside the park home run. And, like, as he's rounding the bases, like, the bases are, like, sticking to his cleats. But
he's
like,
just
he's still
making
going
it work. For it. Yeah.
And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, on that erudite moment, thank you so much for joining us for our discussion of how to play baseball.
Guys, we can talk forever about
anything,
even the shortest thing.
We were both English majors, and so this is what we were trained to do.
If you're still listening at this point, you probably know this already.
Yes, yes. And if you are still listening at this point, thank you very much. And if you, in fact, enjoyed it tremendously, please give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. It helps other people find the podcast. Or you can tell another friend about it. And
why not both?
Why not?
Gift.
Why not both? And you could also write us a review. It can be brief, but I'm going to read some excerpts Ooh. From a review by jchristie1515. And he writes, basically, it's a 2-for. 1, serious, detailed film analysis from movie insiders. 2, crazy fun and informed baseball knowledge in the context of classic baseball movies. Ellen and Eric are both very talented actors, and what you get from this podcast is an insider perspective to filmmaking. They use this conceit of rating a film as if it's a baseball prospect, but through this format they go deep into what makes a film good or not. In their discussion of acting, storytelling, score, etc., they get really detailed into specific scenes and moments. They often have different perspectives, but they aren't afraid to disagree, but not in such a way that you're concerned about their marriage. I feel like we've perhaps demonstrated that very thing on this very episode.
Good God, I hope so.
As for baseball, well, they know their baseball, and it's seriously fun to hear them geek out on baseball in the context of a movie. Does the intentional walk feel real or fake? Is the Bears' nemesis, the Yankees, of course, realistically good? It matters. Seriously, so much fun to listen to. Of course, Ellen being a Phillies fan is an added bonus. Yankees fans, this is a safe space for you, as Ellen and Eric are kind and empathetic people, but Ellen's distaste for the Yankees comes through and will be appreciated by fans of 29 of 30 MLB teams. Enjoy. So
that is
lovely. It's the best review we've ever received. And
I think so.
So long that I was just like, every time our episode is so long that I'm like, well, I can't read it this time. And I thought, this time, no matter what happens, I'm going to read it. So thank you, jchristie1515. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
And next time, we are going to be talking about a couple of episodes of Seinfeld.
De Boyfriend.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Those very fantabulous and iconic Keith Hernandez episodes of Seinfeld.
Yes. I don't offhand know like what season and episode numbers they are, but I am sure that if you put Seinfeld baseball episodes into your search engine of choice, that you will come up with them. And if you would like to find us on the internets between now and then, my Twitter handle is @Ellen_Adair. And on Instagram, I'm @EllenAdairG or @EllenDrawsBaseball, where you can commission from me a drawing of a baseball or other thing.
And I am at Eric Guilty on both of those things, and I will draw you a goof if you want.
He'd probably be pretty good at it, too.
You just gotta ask. I'm like an okay drawer, but I feel like my goofs would be like really good. So now's the time, really, to
it's
ask.
True. It's true. And we will talk to you next time on Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Bye, guys! Old boy.